Welcome to the Practical Backpacking Podcast.
This is Episode 5, and I'm Bernie Wilt. In this episode, I speak with survival and outdoor skills expert Cody Lundeen. Cody has been featured on national and international media programs such as The Today Show, The Discovery Channel, The History Channel, Dateline NBC, and CBC Radio 1 in Canada. Cody has been a consultant and or instructor for various organizations including, but not limited to, FEMA, The Travel Channel, Men's Health Magazine, REI, the Boy Scouts of America, the United States Forest Service, National Geographic Television, National Geographic Adventure Magazine, the Discovery Channel, and Damascus Trail Days. He is the author of the book 98.6 Degrees, The Art of Keeping Your Ass Alive, and the founder and director of the Aboriginal Living Skills School in Prescott, Arizona. Here's the conversation that I had with Cody Lundeen.
Hello.
Hi, Cody. How are you?
Hi, Bernie. How are you doing?
Oh, pretty good. I appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to do the podcast.
No problem.
Well, there's a lot to cover, and you're a fascinating guy, so let's get right into it. How'd you become interested in the wilderness and venturing out?
Well, basically, I'm an only kid, so I spent a lot of time out in the backcountry, whether it was urban backcountry or literal backcountry, and spent a lot of time alone and found the one commonality wherever we lived, because my dad was Air Force, so I grew up a military brat, was Mother Nature. So she was my buddy growing up. And one thing led to another, and basically that's what spawned it all. Also a passion for doing more with less in general.
Okay. And have you done much in the way of traditional backpacking?
Not really. I mean, yeah, we backpacked and we did canoe trips up to the Boundary Waters, you know, with my family. But I've always been more interested, instead of just going through country, to actually, you know, spend some time in that country or know what I'm walking through, instead of kind of having the scuba tank on my back and having to go back when the oxygen's low. You know what I mean?
I understand.
So I'm more into, and I like to walk barefoot a lot too, so a through hiker would just blow me in the dust, you know, covering 10 miles, 20 miles a day, because they can cruise through open country or whatever a lot easier than I can. I have to pay attention, one, to where I'm walking, because I'm barefoot by choice, and two, I want to pay attention to where I'm going, because my whole deal is what's in the woods, not just, you know, blowing through the woods. And I'm not saying that's just what backpackers do, but when I do, and at times I do have the proverbial gear bubble, I don't have to pay as much attention, period, you know, and I like to pay attention. That's part of what I do.
You're more about the journey than the destination, so to speak.
Pretty much, you know. I dig the destination too, but yeah, there's a lot of cool stuff in the journey, and there's a huge journey in just an acre of woods. There's a lot going on, and I'm way more into the flora and fauna in an intimate way, as far as, you know, I could make fire with this, I could frankly trap and eat that, or whatever, than just going and seeing country and blazing through. I'm into spending time with an area and seeing if I can blow this myth of living off the land or not, which I think is a lot of mythology, especially in our day and age. I think there's a lot of BS in my field.
What do you mean by that?
So, people that teach survival skills can be totally full of you-know-what, you know, because
right.
of the Rambo thing, because of the Hollywood deal. There's, you know, people are stunned. Well, why can't you live off the land indefinitely? Well, if you read about indigenous cultures, you know why they died young, you know. And in my area, in Arizona, while it has more geographical diversity within the shortest drive time of any place in North or South America, it's an ass-kicker, and it's an ass-kicker because there's lack of water. And water brings you the flora, which brings you the fauna, which brings, you know, the dinner table on full. So there's areas around here, it's incredibly challenging. I have a high respect for indigenous peoples all over the world, but especially in the Southwest and, you know, even up into the Great Basin deserts in Utah and Montana, because it was so challenging just to get by. Survival sucks, and I want to live, but there's some real marginal areas out there, and I'm living in one, frankly, but I have technology to help me through a few bumps.
I think a lot of people do overlook what the indigenous people of the Southwest have had to endure to stay alive.
You've also spent 2 years living in the woods. Tell me about that.
Yeah. I was living in a brush shelter, a wickiup, I'll call it, and the wickiup looks a lot like a teepee, except it's just all brush. There's no buffalo hide or nowadays canvas covers. It's a cone work, a lattice work of, in my case, ponderosa pine that was Forest Service cut. It was piled into a cone with whatever else I could find on that. And that was a blast. It was a big challenge because it's a two-week stay limit in our national forest, and I was there for 2 years, so it's kind of incognito. I know that you've never done anything illegal, right, Bernie? You know, that's all. Everything's above board. So I was living kind of on the cuff and having to, frankly, hide, not so much from the feds, but just from dumb teenage kids that once they did find my place when I was no longer living there, it was a hell of a party place. So they would just party up, and, of course, they trashed it. So it was very challenging physically, mentally, and emotionally, and just as rewarding on all those three levels as well, because of I built it myself and, you know, lived on a pine needle bed, slept on a pine needle bed, cooked over an open fire, etc. And it sounds a little romantic and groovy, and the fact is that I biked in, stashed my bike in the woods, walked the rest of the way in, and I imported my water and I brought my food. So it wasn't like I was eating pack rats out there and then going back in, and you know, I was doing stained glass work at the time as a job in town. But still, it was enough to where it gets you very close to the land very quick when you live inside the land, literally.
So who have you found to be influential in your life with regard to survival skills? You know, any authors of books or any groups of people or...
I don't read a lot of books on survival because I think a lot of them are bullshit. I think a lot of them are just copied from other books that were copied from stuff that was done in the 30s or 40s by the military or whatever. I have some people I highly respect because I've seen them perform and I've been their pupil, and probably my top guy, my mentor, the person I prostrate at his feet, worship daily, you know, deify him, throw the holy water all over his body, is Morris Kachansky, and he's in Alberta, Canada, and is an instructor in boreal skills. So we have boreal forest here, too, in Arizona at about 9,000, 11,000 foot elevation. But he's the master, and not just in what he teaches, but how he teaches. Because you can have an incredibly skilled person in wilderness backcountry skills who, frankly, will bore you silly if you sit in front of them. So you need to be an engaging instructor as well, and he was and still is. And I actually went to train with him up for 1 month alone with the god himself, Morris Kachansky. I think it was in 91. And he's got to be in his 60s now, in his early 60s or so. And I was in my, I don't know, I was just a hell of a lot younger than I am now, and I'm still young right now. And he physically wore me out. I got ill and had to spend a day in his trailer. Just said, man, leave me alone. You were just, he's an animal. So he's one of those energizer bunny type of guys who also has a good heart, who also is not full of bullshit, who also has almost zero ego, and who really should, because he's that good.
Wow, that's great. Do you stay in touch with him?
On and off, yeah. I mean, I might see him or talk to him every couple years or 3 years, but he's kind of like my, you know, an uncle figure for sure, and I buy him pizza or whatever, and when I see him. But, you know, Canada's a hell of a long way from where I am, you know, and I wish I could bring him down here, but if I do, I need to set up a class because he needs to make some dough when he travels because he's damn well worth it, and he's way, way cheap, in my opinion, for what he charges anyway. And there's others along the line, too, Jim Riggs, Steve Watts, Dave Gansey. What I tend to look for, Bernie, is specialists in their field. If I want to learn about desert survival, I'll go to someone like Dave Gansey, who used to teach Special Forces desert survival, and then I'll suck their brain dry, do the old Vulcan mind meld on them, and then try to take it a step further. And I hope someone does that with me someday. But so yeah, I have my mentors like probably everyone does, and they're just worth their weight in gold.
Okay, wonderful. For those that don't know, you're also the author of a best-selling book, 98.6 Degrees, The Art of Keeping Your Ass Alive.
Yeah, you cuffed, Bernie.
Yeah, I think I've heard other people mention that title of the book, and they skip over that for some reason. I'm not so sure why, but they do.
I'm not sure why either.
Well, I noticed through the book you don't mince words, and you get right to the point. And I'd like to ask you some questions about survival. You cover so much material in your book, and it's not practical to go over it all. But if you don't mind, we can touch on some of the highlights. Regarding mental preparation, I want to read this short paragraph from your book. It just stuck out to me so much because I felt like I've read some of those recycled military surplus books and things like that, and I get into it a little bit and throw it down because I realize that it really doesn't identify much with practically doing it, so I put it aside. But anyway, this paragraph really speaks to me. It's, survival is 90% psychology. When the chips are down, it doesn't matter what you've buried in your backyard or how many books on survival you've read. If you're a mental and emotional basket case during your survival episode, you're toast. The benefits of a positive attitude are many, and they range from improving your health and aiding disease resistance to putting more money in your bank account. Science has proven that attitude, self-esteem, and humor influence changes in heart rate, hormones, and body chemistry. All living cells respond instantaneously to every thought and feeling we have. I love that last sentence especially.
Wrote that, man. That was just pure genius. Who wrote that?
You wrote it on page 25 of your book. I seen it that way, and the reason being is because it really spoke to me. I've always been a firm believer that if a doctor tells somebody they got 2 weeks to live or something like that, and they agree with it for whatever reason, their cells begin to shut down. They begin to prepare for death. And when I read what your book has to say about it, it really made me feel like I picked up the right book because I believe that that's where it all starts, in the mind.
Yeah, you're right on. And I'm actually doing a book on urban survival now for the same publisher. And I'm going to dare to do what I've never seen anyone do before as a survival instructor and actually try to get to the cause of disasters in general, whether it's in your personal life or global or whatnot, instead of reading with the effect, which is what most people do. Like I said before, when I lived in the woods and I told you I was broke, which I was, it was still my choice to live in the woods. So I'll fully own everything I've done, for better or for worse. But in reality, whatever I put my attention on and put my thought on and fill it with my feeling world and then use the spoken word or back it up with my actions manifests in my life. And I know this sounds like a groovy, let's hug a tree and burn some incense type stuff, but it's basic manifestation 101, and we're all doing it. We're all doing it 24/7, but we're not conscious of that. So that's like giving a three-year-old a knife, a very sharp knife, and the knife's going to do damage. The knife is going to work regardless of them being conscious or not of how it's used. And so you're right on. And what I'm trying to do with this next book is just get beyond even what you just read out of that book and go a little bit deeper for those that might be ready about taking personal responsibility and being truly self-reliant. Because that's what I'm most passionate about, is freedom and self-responsibility and self-reliance. And if you own it, if Bernie or Cody owns that they're master of their own world and that we create our own world on multiple levels, then we're not going to be a victim. Screw being a victim. It sucks. It's a drag. Just like survival's a drag. I want to live. So, there's a lot to it. Way much beyond this podcast, but you're right on. If you can take that being responsible, that's true utter self-reliance there, standing on one foot and not bouncing around, standing on two legs and not bouncing on one foot.
So what are some ways to become mentally prepared? How can a person mentally prepare for a survival situation?
Think about it beforehand, and there's a fine line between what I just said and manifesting a survival situation. Okay, whatever I put my attention on or thought and feeling, I bring into my world. But let's say I'm going hiking on a trail, which I do a lot, with or without backpack or gear. Mm-hmm. I'm always, just because I enjoy it, thinking, I could make a shelter there. I could make a fire with that tree over there, and I'm talking about fire by friction with sticks, not burning the tree down. et cetera, et cetera. So my mind kind of works that way because I enjoy squeaking out more from less. And I'd recommend for backpackers, get educated on a landscape you're walking through more intimately, like the native peoples were. They just didn't put on a pack and go cruise through foreign country. They did, but they asked grandma, who'd been that route before, about what to expect. And then they rolled with it as best they could. But start throwing out scenarios, because one thing that's common in all survival scenarios or lists of people that, you know, eventually something happens to them was that it's not going to happen to me factor, right? The denial, you know, this survival situation, that happened to so-and-so, but it's not going to happen to me. Mm-hmm. And if it does and when it does happen to you, if you spend enough time out in the backcountry, I don't need to tell you, something's going to go up. You know, because when you combine human nature with mother nature, anything can go. Those are the two categories with the most variables that I can think of. And a person who's in denial that might not even know it, when they find themselves in a life-threatening situation and their heart rate does go up and they find their fine and complex motor skills compromised because of that, they're going to freak out even more because they've never even thought about taking responsibility when the chips are down if something goes wrong. They like to lose their backpack or whatever. So that's a huge, it's just realizing it can happen to you, it can happen to me, it can happen to your listeners, and to realize what will kill you first. And that's one of the reasons I wrote 98.6 degrees, the art of keeping your ass alive, is because that's typical core body temperature. And the biggest cause of death of all outdoor enthusiasts all over the world is dying of hypothermia, low body temperature, low core body temperature, or hyperthermia. It's not grizzly bears, it's not starvation, it's not rattlesnakes, it's not scorpions. It's failing to thermoregulate body temperature.
Yeah,
and when you simplify, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry, go ahead.
When you simplify how people will die, then you can pack lighter as a backpacker, and it's not so scary when you simplify all the isms that could happen. Because people freak out. If you actually knew all the ways you could bite it in the woods, you'd stay home and watch Oprah. If you realized how most people die most of the time and use that to your advantage, training your mind, training your heart, and packing for that scenario, then you're lessening the evils and you're more likely to be able to adapt to a scenario if it goes bad.
Yeah, back on the mental thing, when you said that you're walking through the woods and you're observing the things that are around you, a general awareness of your surroundings so that you know what to use if you need to, reminds me of like a photographer that may be looking for a certain composition for a photo or whatever. You know, if we do that when we're in the backcountry and look where is an additional source of water, even though we have what we think is enough now, to keep looking for those things that we may need in the event of a survival situation. And you touched on fear and then the core body temperature. Those are actually the next couple of things I wanted to discuss. The fear factor is a big thing. I mean, the hunters in the woods that become lost have been known to throw their guns down and take off running. People have ran right off of cliffs. How does one manage fear when it first starts coming on like that? What's the first thing you do?
Well, there's an old acronym that's in a lot of the survival books out there that does make sense psychologically and physiologically, is the old STOP thing. And I turned it into STOPA. The S stands for stop. You physically sit your ass down and stop. If you're thinking while you're walking or running or whatever, it ain't going to happen. You physically have to sit down, and sometimes that's a force issue. To do that when you're starting, and you panic, you might be done. You want to catch this before you get into panic. Stop, sit your body down. The T stands for think. Still your mind, think about your situation. The O stands for observe. We've been talking about observation pretty much this whole time. The P stands for making a plan, and it might be plan A, B, or C. Always have options. And the A stands for act, and that could just mean sitting there waiting for rescue. So one of the first things to do is, frankly, try to chill out. That's not an option when you're being charged by a grizzly bear. But, you know, that's not the odds that that's going to be happening to you. Most survival situations don't just happen. They're a continuum of small little things that go wrong that people blow off. If we look at hypothermia, the body will shiver. Then you'll start to slow your speech or stumble. Your skin will be numb. you'll lose your motor dexterity. This could go on for a couple hours. And if this dumbass doesn't stop and warm themselves up, you're going to die, potentially, unless some outward party looks at Uncle Frank and realizes, wow, you know, this guy's starting to check out. It's largely the same in most typical outdoor survival situations, is there's things that lead up to that. That sprained ankle, the person was probably fatigued or dehydrated or whatever. So it's important not just to pay attention to your external environment, you pay attention to your internal environment. What color is your pee? It should be clear. It means you're maximally hydrated, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's really this constant, it's not a battle, it's not paranoia, it's just paying attention. And if you do it long enough, like anything else, it becomes automatic. And that's that seasoned, scout-like backpacker who's in tune with their inner landscape, like they are their outer landscape, that's much more liable to prevent something from going on than having to go through the wicked aftermath of reeling in the effect, like we've been talking about.
Okay. And, you know, as the title goes, 98.6 degrees, your book stresses that very important factor of regulating or maintaining one's body core temperature, 98.6 degrees. And, you know, I've seen people when I've been in the desert, backpacking, hiking through Arizona and some of the Southwest, I've seen people, less concerned about, hypothermia, but they don't realize that, you know, when they get into a situation, things can go from, say, 100 degrees to 50 degrees, when the sun goes down and maybe the cool night air is blowing a little. And, if they're wet, having just crossed a stream or something like that. So there's different situations. You have to prepare regardless, for, you know, any contingencies.
Oh, heck yeah. That's the old Boy Scout motto, be prepared. And the cool thing about backpackers in general is they have an arsenal of survival stuff on their back. You know, I did a thing, I've done several TV things. I did a thing for, oh, what was that show? It's called, I think, What Should You Do or What Would You Do? Lisa Gibbons was the host. And we shot three things, and it was a woman-based show. All three scenarios were, that's not true, there was one guy scenario in an avalanche. But, you know, they were, same thing, proper preparation, and they were getting themselves into just nasty situations on the simple day hike that they had to then get themselves out, because the simple day hike situation, they don't prepare. The backpacker, on the other hand, there was one lady that in California, she went off a cliff, and she fractured, I think, both of her femurs, or she was down for the count. It was either tib fracture or something, but guess what? She had that sleeping bag. She had her camp stove right there, and she was able to be independent literally for 3 or 4 days until someone managed to hear her yell from the trail that remained above. So backpackers have a huge advantage over day hikers or anyone else, because they have a lot of key ways to keep their core thermoregulated, whether it's hot or cold weather, you know, in that backpack. If they're planning ahead to whatever bioregion they're going to. You know, if you're going down to my country, to the Sonoran Desert, it's just a little bit south of me in July, you know, you don't want to pack like you're in Alaska. So you have to manipulate your gear, which everyone out there is saying probably, duh. But, you know, then why are we dying like flies out here? You know, because some people don't. There is no one-size-fits-all backpacking gear. There's close things like cutting edges and fire and clothing, any more than there's any one-size-fits survival kit. You know, you have to roll with whatever Mother Nature throws at you.
Okay. A couple more areas that I want to discuss before we move on to talk about your school. What would you suggest or recommend that a backpacker have in their pack for a minimum amount of survival gear? With the advent of the ultralight backpacking movement and things like that, a lot of backpackers are more conscious or conscientious of making sure that they carry lighter weight gear and everything. So what would you recommend that's the absolute minimum that they should carry? I know this is going to have to be a general answer because it depends on where they're going and what they're doing, but, you know, some of the typical things that they'd have to make sure that they definitely had in their pack.
Extra clothing. Okay, the easiest way under stress or otherwise to regulate core body temperature is clothing and water. It sounds so mundane and boring that no one wants to put it on TV, right? But you have extra clothing, be it desert or winter country, and then you have extra water or and ways to disinfect water out in the field, whether it's tincture of iodine or your filter or whatever, extra water capacity. That would be minimal to regulate body temperature. Right after that, I would have some way, preferably more than one, to signal for rescue, a glass sightable signal mirror, a whistle at very minimal. You know, you can throw in a garbage bag, a 55-gallon drum liner or Divine. And, you know, if someone you know's kid got busted smoking pot and he's picking up trash on the side of the road, they have those awesome blaze orange huge trash bags that they're picking up trash in. Something highly visible, multiple use, it can catch rain, etc. So we've got clothing, we've got water, we've got a way to signal for rescue. That's minimal. Some sort of vapor barrier protection if you don't have a Gore-Tex shell or something to keep your insulation dry, again, depending on where you're at, but it does rain in the desert too. And if someone feels more skilled, there's almost nothing you can't do with a cutting edge and fire. And my cutting edge of choice, of course, is a metal knife. And I would carry at least a couple ways. Personally, I carry at least three ways to make fire, different ways on three different areas of my body. So I might have striking wood kitchen matches and a match safe in my pocket. I might have a lighter in my fanny pack, and I might have a magnesium bar with striking insert in my backpack itself. If you get separated with something, you don't never, ever put all your eggs in one basket. And I'd say that you can't go wrong with cord. You know, 50 or 100 pound, 500 pound test, maybe 50 or 100 feet of parachute line or whatever you can find. And those are some real minimal things. You know, you can always carry more stuff, right, as far as survival gear. And I've been given a little bit of a hard time for, well, his survival kit is 4.5 pounds. Well, I have real stuff in that survival kit. My knife is a real knife, not a razor blade. You know, it's not a toy, because I want full-size, real tools, because I'm dealing in real situations where they're really stressful, and if I have these little toys, you're not even able to hold that razor blade. You could throw in a space blanket. You know, there's the shiny type, smaller one, the big type that almost doubles as a tarp that has grommets. But minimally, Bernie, the easiest way when people are scared to regulate core body temperature is clothing and water. But that doesn't do any good if you're sitting your butt out there without a way to signal for rescue. And before you leave on your backpacking trip, you leave a 5-point game plan, who, what, where, why, how, etc., about where in the heck you are in the backcountry. Because 90% or more of all modern scenario rescues are third-party based, which means search and rescue is going to come bail you out of your situation. If no one knows where you are or when you're going to be back, you're screwed. You're on your own.
Okay. Yeah, I've noticed in talking with some people that they say, well, I'm just going on a day hike or something like that. And I've usually told them that those are probably the most likely cases that something's going to go wrong, when people aren't prepared and they think they're just going for, you know, a 2-3-4 mile walk. And I think I read somewhere in your book that you said that people have died near the parking lot or a road from where they put in at a trailhead.
Yeah, by far, other than hypo and hyperthermia being the most prominent way people die in the backcountry or even urban wherever, like we're talking about, the scenario that sets it up is the simple day hike. And it's exactly what you're saying, is because they don't prepare. Hey, it's only a 3-mile loop. Leave the water in the truck. Ain't nothing going to happen, et cetera, et cetera. And it just stings people all the time. It's especially in Arizona when it starts to get hot. You have so-and-so's relatives that came in from New Hampshire, and they're just doing that little 2- or 4-mile-hour loop. You know, right, you know, you can see Phoenix. It's just, you know, it's everything's Phoenix nowadays down south, and they die like flies, and they get lost all the time, you know. And the, you know, the Grand Canyon, there's over 400 search and rescue missions in the Grand Canyon alone every year. That's more than one idiot per day down there getting compromised, largely because they go from air-conditioned bus to some place that's, you know, could be 110 degrees, the bottom of that canyon.
Yeah, that's quite a change, and I don't think they know what it means to walk out of there. That's
exactly
quite a walk.
Yeah, again, it all revolves around lack of preparation, and whether that's a cockiness or whatever it is. There's a whole list of excuses. Get homeitis. I told my wife I'd be home by so and so. We've got to summit that peak. We paid $300. By God, we're going to do it. To hell with the storm that's moving in. When human nature meets Mother Nature, all hell can break loose.
I remember people like during the winter, like in Chicago and places, Buffalo, New York, places that get heavy snow, you hear about these people dropping dead from shoveling snow. And likewise, extensive hiking, out of a canyon or something like that gets that heart rate up quite a bit, and they dehydrate, and next thing they know, they're experiencing heat exhaustion or heat stroke.
It's not that difficult because, you know, the demographics are, you know, even for seasoned backpackers, that we spend 90% of our time indoors nowadays and 10% outside. You know, 100 years ago or so in more rural areas, that used to be just the opposite because you were out plowing the field or whatever. So just being outside, you know how it is, just taking a 2 or 3 day camping trip with anything short of an RV, and you come home and you feel great, but you also feel pretty whipped because the wind and the sun and all that stuff takes its toll, you know, let alone being in a survival situation with maybe broken, minimal, or obsolete gear and trying to, you know, get you and your loved one out alive.
Yeah, I've often thought about the differences of, you know, like the when we were talking about the core body temperature, even if you're 98.6 degrees, and if it's 50 degrees outside, I mean, that's 48.6 degrees difference, and that's quite a bit. So if we're not ready for that, you know, bad things can go wrong. I think people think in order to be hypothermic, it has to be you know, like below zero or 30 degrees or freezing or something.
No, the most common, between like 35 to 55 degrees approximately, give or take a few degrees, is the prime candidate for dying of hypothermia. Because if it's really cold outside, by God, you have the gear, you know, because or else you die real quick. So at least you have either winter backpacking gear, an extra coat. But when it's nice and it's 60, 65 out in the mountains, and that storm moves in and all of a sudden it's 30, you know, in an hour, that's when it catches people off guard. So it's that fringe area, you know, it's and that is the most responsible for killing people of low body temperature.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about your school. You're the founder, director, and head instructor of the Aboriginal Living Skills School in Prescott, Arizona. Tell me a little bit about the school and the courses you offer.
Okay. Well, what I do in my school, the Aboriginal Living Skills School, I teach modern survival skills, which is what we've been talking about, you know, the classic backpacking trip gone wrong type stuff, all the way to primitive living skills, which is what I'm immersed in right now. I just came up the hill from my kids building this elaborate willow shelter, you know, with blades and using the willow bark to tie the stuff together, etc., to now I'm also getting into kind of more urban self-reliance, not just urban survival, like I'm going to eat my dog. I want to still steer clear of that stuff, but just more home preparedness stuff. I live in a remote backcountry setting. I'm talking to you on a cell phone via solar-charged batteries. I live underground in an earth home that controls its own temperature. I don't need to burn any wood to heat it in the winter. I don't need to cool it in the summer because I thought about the design. I catch water in the earth, I catch water on surfaces, so I'm trying to be as self-sufficient as possible out here, and I'm offering classes as well in more like urban self-sufficiency, because I think it's direly needed, you know, for obvious reasons in our current world affairs. So I do the hardcore outdoor survival, the primitive living skills, and some modern survival and home preparedness, kind of homesteading skills, and they're all under the umbrella of self-reliance.
Okay, so it could range from just telling people what to have, you know, on hand in the event of an emergency in their household, all the way to going out and into a wilderness situation and actually surviving off of the land.
Yeah, like with this, I'm in the middle of this 19-day course, like I mentioned, and the finale of this course will be we're way out in the backcountry right now at my place, but we're preparing gear, making Stone Age gear from scratch, and then we'll take a 5-day field trip in a very, very remote part of Arizona where Geronimo actually used to run around like a crazy person and do it and try to live off the land as best we can. I have a permit, a scientific collection permit from Game and Fish where I can harvest critters in other ways that would be illegal for most people. And we put it to the test, and we'll see how it does living off the land, moving through back country with all primitive gear, willow pack frames, cattail sleeping mats, stone knives, fire by friction set, deadfall traps, and snares, and gourd canteens, and all Stone Age gear except the clothes on our back. And how does this feel to try to make a living off the land? We're not just popping open the bag of gorp, you know, firing up the peak one. We have to trap the pack rat and make the fire with sticks if we want to eat. So it's a real challenge.
Okay. And not everything is that hardcore. Do I have it right? Is there some things that are...
For you, Bernie. It's only hardcore for you.
Okay.
No, not everything is like that. Like I mentioned, I have a course, Staying Alive, that Annette McGivney in Backpacker Magazine, I think in 1999, featured in that magazine. And it's about, you know, it's a two-day course. I have an extended version of that called the Arizona Combo Special, which is 7 days, which is, you know, the basics of shelter, fire, signaling for rescue, and water. You know, what's the truth about solar stills? How do I make fire? How do I control it? How do I put it out? You know, how do I make improvised shelters in the woods of the desert? And how do I set up a tarp correctly? You know, and the real stuff that any basic camper, day hiker, or backpacker should know. Where, you know, you're bringing your own food or on longer courses, I'm feeding you a couple times a day, and I'm working your butt off, but no, we're not out there eating bugs and, you know, walking across harsh desert terrain. It's, you have your backpack, you have your sleeping bag, you have your bedroll, you can bring as much food as you want, and you're there to learn the skills. So okay. I offer ranges of all sorts of stuff like that.
Okay, good. Well, you certainly got my respect. I've spent some time out in the superstition wilderness in the middle of summer, and I'll tell you what, that was rough. That's about as bad as it's ever been for me. At the same time, I enjoyed it probably more than anything I've done, too, just because of putting myself to the test like that and the things that I've seen around me, and it was very rewarding, and it's stuck with me all these years. You also have something like a 4x4 survival class. What's that all about?
Yeah, with Moses Liddell. Moses Liddell is to four-wheel drives what Moors is to the boreal forest in Canada. He's actually just one of the most renowned four-wheel drive people. I met him at Camp Jeep. Backpacker Magazine hired me to give a lecture there, I don't know, a few years ago, I think in Branson, Missouri. And, of course, Moses Liddell wrote all these Jeep owners' Bibles guides. You know, the big manuals, tear down your Jeep and rebuild it back up. And I met him there and knew his, you know, name and, again, prostrated myself at his feet. And we got to be friends and decided to put on this course together regarding, okay, well, guess how a lot of scenarios start in the backcountry. The vehicle breaks down or we get the Jeep stuck on the camping trip or whatever it is. So my thing is to do a skill similar to my Staying Alive course, again, fire, shelter, water, signaling for rescue. And his was, how do you get the vehicle out? How do you do field repairs? You know, how do you use come-alongs and all that sort of stuff? And so it was a lot of fun working with him. One, because of his complete professionalness and his just, I mean, he's been doing this for longer than I've been alive. You know, I mean, way back in like the 50s or so, he did the Rubicon Trail and this, like, you know, almost a Jeep. So he's just really a renowned four-wheel drive guy. It was a pleasure to work with him.
Oh, great. Do you have any plans? I know you mentioned a book earlier, but plans for books, TV shows, documentaries, or anything, upcoming courses, new courses?
The newest course I have is called the First Annual Self-Reliance Symposium. It's in October, mid-October. And when I was referencing kind of homesteading, urban survival, etc., I decided to put together this new course that'll have the best of everything I know at this point in time for 7 days regarding if the grid goes down, for lack of a better word, what you want to have. You know, it's based on my new book that'll be out, I think, September of 07. I'm still writing it, still doing the illustrations with the illustrator, etc. So it'll have elements of primitive living skills, elements of modern outdoor survival, elements of homesteading, and elements of urban survival. So, you know, we'll be using solar ovens to what do you store for food, from canned goods to dry goods to etc., to how do you kill the rat that's in your food with the hair on your head and a rock in your backyard, to how do you cook the rat, and just kind of all these different things, kind of the best stuff I know, along with guest instructors on aquaculture, raising fish. The colleges are doing an awesome job, and you know, $500,000 greenhouses here, and doing hydroponics, passive solar design, composting, et cetera, et cetera. So, and that'll be held here at my place too. So it's like a symposium on self-reliance that's more so dealing with a modern day person, that if I couldn't go to Kmart or if I couldn't go to the grocery store, what would I need? If I couldn't go shopping and replenish my supply, and if not, how do I improvise as best I can for my environment to get my immediate needs met and long-term needs?
Okay, that sounds great. How long does that last? How long is the course?
It's a 7-day course. So that's my newest one, and nothing really. I mean, there's always stuff with potential TV, but nothing's happened, and so nothing's happened. That's one of the most flaky mediums I've ever done, is that, because things change on a whim. So even I've done stuff that's been shot that hasn't aired, so it's just a matter of there's nothing on that horizon right now that's tangible at all.
Okay. Yeah, I've noticed they've been putting more and more survival-like shows on Discovery Channel and whatnot recently.
I know.
I always thought
they call it on coaching or whatever, and I don't know what the deal is with them, but I just, I need to be paid for my work, and there's a lot of production companies that want me to do stuff for free or whatever. Well, they're not doing it for free. I just turned down a company from London that's doing a 12-part series for the Discovery Channel on survival skills. One, because I kind of didn't agree with it, and two, because they weren't willing to pay anything.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm in this to make a living. This is my business, and I want to be in the summer. So there's a lot of BS on TV and a lot of stuff that, people will bend over backwards and do it for free, and I don't want to do that anymore. I need to make a living doing what I'm doing, and so I've sacrificed some stuff just for the fact that, I'm still supposed to be enamored by the fact that, you could be on TV. Well, it's like, whatever,
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
So yeah, I certainly do.
I have a love-and-hate relationship with that aspect.
Okay. Well, I know there is a show, I think it was a couple of years ago or so, I seen you featured on, I think it was a Discovery Channel show.
Yeah, probably Lost in the Wild.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we did a couple pilots and that went nowhere. Part of the reason, because they chose to air it on the night that Survivor was on. That's going to, cable is a dime a dozen nowadays. History, Discovery, whatever. It's, when you're trying to gun against CBS and NBC and ABC, you're going to lose,
mm-hmm.
Because those networks still rule. And there's more cable channels than you can shake a stick at now. And it doesn't really mean a whole lot, in my mind, being on TV anymore, because anyone can. I mean, look at reality television. And there's other stuff that might be in the works with producers that I don't want to get into, but it's just, it's not really. I'd like to do a show that was real, that actually taught, that wasn't so rigged and wasn't so phony and wasn't. So I've done some stuff that's been incredibly phony for television because I'm not calling the shots. The person with the money is, and we could go round and round about this because again, I have a lot of weird experiences with that, but. Just don't believe everything you see on TV. It's television.
Right.
It's entertainment, for God's sake, So, but I think that it's such an awesome medium. It would be nice to do something that was fun and interesting to watch, but still really gonzo educational. I'm not saying what's out there is not, but I don't know. I just think maybe they're just getting better. I don't have TV. I don't watch it. I think it's a waste of time. So how would I know?
Yeah.
I haven't watched it in several years,
What about doing something like a documentary, like DVD or something like that, like a series of survival training DVDs or something like that? Have you thought about doing anything like that?
People have asked me for years on that, and I've been approached by several people that wanted to film, and it just hasn't worked out, and I'm not sure, I guess I'm in the loop. And so what I see is kind of a glut I see, you know, well, why don't you get so-and-so's DVD? And I'm really into the book. I'm happy to do the books. I think that that's it's a way I can reach. I'm after reaching the audience that doesn't want to hear me speak, especially with this urban book. I want to reach the person that doesn't know they have their head up you-know-where. You know, that some inkling, because, again, most of the survival stuff, by the time it goes through the several legions of editors at the Discovery Channel or whoever, it's bullshit. You know, it's just been, you know, I've had producers tell me, can you fall in the river and get hypothermic on this shoot? You know, can we hire actors to have people, they originally wanted actors to play the students in Lost in the Wild. And luckily the producer said, no, just get real people. And when we did those shoots, it was originally a B production, which means that an A is like American Chopper. You know, that's their baby. You know, that's their bread and butter. And so B's not bad. By the time they got done shooting those, the show was reduced to a C, and something like two mechanical creatures tearing each other apart won out. So I'm working on some other stuff with this maybe producer in L.A. where the production companies are expecting so much unrational stuff, like we're all such dunderheads that, you know, eating a rat's not enough and catching it with sticks. There has to be some other crap thrown in that it's really a drag. You know, it's really, I don't even call it frustrating. It's Hollywood. It's entertainment. And so it's really hard to be honest and truthful on TV unless you're paying for it, unless you have the deep pockets that are financing it, because you're going through many, many filters. And like Discovery changed gears, something else took precedence. And I remember the original producer that my producer was working with, because how it works is you have independent producers that are known by Discovery Channel in general, that the Discovery Channel hires them out, like an independent company and wherever. A lot of them are around Virginia, you know, and they come approach me or someone else and we do the show. And the main producer in charge of this show at the Discovery Channel was like, oh, I can't believe how fresh and real everything is. And I was thinking, well, no shit, man. You put people out into the woods and don't give them anything. What do you expect? You know, you want me to fall in a lake, get hypothermic? You know, and it kind of hit me right there that when I'm dealing with people that are so far off kilter about what reality really is, and they're trying to make reality television, why would I expect anything more? Why should I expect anything more? It's still a bummer, because I feel I and other people have a lot to offer, and there could be some great shows, and there are great shows, and there will be great shows. But when they want to soup it up and sensationalize it and coat it with a bunch of bullshit, Rambo-esque whatever, it's a buzzkill. You know, it's not necessary. It makes me look bad, not me per se, but that's how this whole survival thing, Bernie, gets started, about living off the land, pursuing these myths, and confusing primitive living skills with modern survival. And that's another reason why I wrote 98.6, is because it was geared to the everyday day hiker or backpacker and how they're going to die if they don't pay attention to certain things. It's not about the Donner Party. It's not about the grizzly bears. It's not about all this stuff that makes great television, or so some producers think. And it can be as mundane as have the right clothing and stay hydrated, but that's reality. The hell with the rest.
Now, when you mentioned the, you know, the Hollywood way of looking at survival and things, it makes me think about some of the martial arts that I've been involved in over the years. I've studied for years now a reality-based martial arts that actually translates into the streets, things that could really happen, whereas a lot of the other traditional martial arts that I've been exposed to, and I know there's good and bad in all of them, so I'm not bashing any one in particular, but they don't seem to translate well into the streets, into real life situations. So, and I can see that with all the glamour and the glitter and things like that, that Hollywood, so to speak, does with some of these survival shows and things, is that it really doesn't translate into what's going on, because, like you say, it's not very interesting.
Well, it'll kill people. You know, your metaphor is spot on. I think the only other The thing I can think of is the most verbose and BS is the martial arts and ultimate fighting let me rip their testicles off their body. Let me take their eye out with my thumb. You can't do that. That's not alternate. You know, in street fighting, you're going to lose an eye, you're going to get your balls ripped off, something's going to happen, something's going to give. You're going to get your throat chopped, your windpipe crushed, low kicks, all this stuff that real combat that was learned from our soldiers getting their butts kicked and trying to kick butt, you know, the stuff that works under stress. And then we can go back into the fine and complex motor skills being lost or compromised completely when the heart rate goes up. And guess what? When you're in a fight, the heart rate goes up. So it's a great metaphor, and you know exactly what I'm talking about. And I guess part of the reason I take issue with some of this stuff is because it does fill people with these wrong conceptions of survival in general. And I don't think that's fair. That's not worth the entertainment value for me. If someone can't separate the bull from the bullshit, I guess we could say that's the gene pool, you know, wake up and smell the coffee. But on the other hand, survival skills are incredibly fascinating. They're awesome. You know, why do you need to sugarcoat this stuff? Show it like it is. Show it raw. Show it uncut. And then people will have a greater respect for the woods and prepare better.
Yep, I agree. So one thing that I'd like to bring up before we go is that I think that some people might take away that your experience or your exposure has been limited to desert-type situations and regions. But Arizona has a lot of different types of climates and ecosystems and whatnot, and you've also been exposed to wilderness situations like in the Rockies, I believe, and the Pacific Coast.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Arizona, like I mentioned, has more geographical diversity in the shortest drive time of any place in North or South America. I mean, look at the Grand Canyon. You can walk from desert down to or up into spruce trees. You can walk it, you know, in a day. If I drive from Flagstaff, Arizona, 3.5 hours south on I-17 to Phoenix, Arizona, I've gone through 10 different life zones. It's like driving from Canada to Mexico. So you can die of hypothermia and hyperthermia in the same day in my state. Arizona has all four North American deserts. It also has stuff that flat out looks like boreal Canada. High, alpine, spruce, fir, ponderosa pine, amazing canyons. I mean, it rocks. And for what I do, outdoors, it's amazing. I teach winter survival, you know, all sorts of stuff that people wouldn't think, including myself. Before I moved here, I thought this was a godforsaken barren wasteland, and I was wrong. It just has some amazing, amazing temperature extremes, terrain extremes, and flora and fauna and all that goes along with it.
Wonderful. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we sign off?
Tell your people to be prepared. Have the basics. Let someone know where you're going before you go. Have basic survival kit material and know how to use it, for God's sake. And dress adequately for the weather and stay hydrated.
Okay. Well, Cody, thank you for sharing your experience and expertise with me and the listeners. I highly recommend that people get a copy of your book and that they look into taking one or more of your courses. I'll be sure to put a link to your book and website on the podcast website.
Well, thanks for the opportunity for talking with you, Bernie.
You're very welcome.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. The Practical Backpacking Podcast is a companion service to the Practical Backpacking Forums, located at www.practicalbackpacking.com. This podcast is copyright 2006 by Practical Backpacking. All rights reserved.